Welcome, and thanks for listening to the Voices of SUD, Let's Grow Together, a pilot podcast brought to you by Southeast Addiction Technology Transfer Center Network, better known as SATTC, where we discuss topics on substance use resources and research, challenges in the addiction workforce, workforce development for young professionals, the millennial, services and support for minority women, treatment and recovery for vulnerable populations such as the homeless, migrant, and incarcerated, faith community strategies, and the evolution of SUDs. Welcome and stay tuned.
Welcome, welcome. It is season two, you guys. Welcome back. Thanks for all listeners who listen to season one, and we appreciate all you all listeners that are new. Thank you for joining us. I am Celine Craig, and as last season, I'm your host for this season as well. We have a great season planned for you all, and I'm excited to have more conversations. We're kicking it off with a young lady named Joy Sebakindu, and she is out of Georgia, and we cover eight states, so we'll be having people from all over the region of Region 4. Super excited. I'm not here to keep you from freaking out. I'm here to be with you while you freak out, or give grief, or laugh, or suffer, or sing. It's a ministry of presence. It is showing up with a loving heart. And that's definitely sits at the core of everything that Joy does. And so Joy Sebakindu graduated from Vanderbilt University with not only her BA in sociology and child development, but also her master's in education with clinical mental health counseling. So Joy comes from over a decade of professional experience with working with children, adolescents, adults, among all levels of care from inpatient to outpatient. And she's also a LPC, which is a licensed professional counselor. So she specializes in working with individuals, couples, families who have issues with communications, family transitioning, including divorce trauma, depression, anxiety, and of course, our favorite topic, substance use, and also other disorders such as eating disorders. So today, Joy is often sought out by advocacy groups and mental health treatment centers and hospitals to consult on multicultural cases due to her personal and professional experience in managing, issues related to diversity, inclusion, and other issues with ethnic sensitivities. I love that buzzword. So combined with her work as project management and behavioral health marketing, as well as her experience as a primary therapist and clinical director of residential programs, which allows Joyce to be a perfect blend for experience and, of course, a perfect guest for our first episode of the second season. She supports those in need as a treatment placement specialist with Acadia Healthcare. And she also maintains her own spa private practice in Atlanta, Georgia. So welcome. Thank you so much for tuning in to our second season. And we're going to jump right in. So thank you so much, Joy, for joining us. You are our first guest on our second season. We are super, super excited. The listeners are ready. They're ready for a fruitful conversation to get things going. We haven't recorded since December, so we're ready. Like, I think COVID kind of just knocked us off, so I'm excited to get into your conversation today. Joy Sebakindu, you're in Atlanta, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, cool. So you're in the same area. So it's a bright sunny day here, and I appreciate you joining us at the beginning of September. We're kicking off recovery month. It's exciting. So just to really start off, we always just like to just give people a platform to tell people what they do, what you're about. Of course, you have like your formal, background biography. But just tell us, like, in your own words, what do you do? What are some of the like important things that you want to mention? And just kind of like those cool like things that make your job unique.
Yeah. Celine, first off, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm so thrilled to be here with you and really just have this fruitful conversation. It has been a extremely long year, so I am very honored to be kicking off the season with you guys. But I am a licensed professional counselor based here in Atlanta, and have been practicing for nearly a decade and have you know, been a helper, as I like to say, for the majority of my life, working with families, working in ministry, and full-time, I work as a treatment placement specialist with Acadia Healthcare. And so I have had lots of experience throughout the last decade or so, working in multiple levels of care, working in my private practice, working as a clinical director at a residential treatment center, and now working to support individuals and families in navigating residential care. So I really work with people as they are looking for treatment for various concerns in mental health. I can place for primary substance use, eating disorders, chronic pain, trauma, PTSD, really working to support people in their journey to overall health and well-being.
Okay, well, that sounds like a soliloquy. It sounded really, really good. I love it. Awesome. Okay. So with all that being said, that was a mouthful. And
yes, it was. Sorry.
It was really intricate. I mean, that's like a unique position, you know, like as a treatment specialist, because you kind of play a role in between like community and kind of like the kind of institutional, you know, like treatment, you know, clinical side of things. And it's kind of just playing in both roles, because you have to know your population, but you also, you know, have to know the clinical aspect as well.
Absolutely.
So I think it's cool to kind of be like right there in the middle, kind of wedge between the two. So I know that and we have to speak on it because of what this actual podcast episode is about. At Morehouse School of Medicine, of course, we are at HBCU. So we are historically black college and university. And so our inclusion disparity work looks a little differently as we're fighting a good fight for the people we know, you know, deserve it, that are, you know, in equitable situations and underserved. But how does that look working at Acadia as it being a majority Caucasian white, you know, or organization? How does that look as far as kind of just like the climate of where we're in? What are you guys doing? Are you, you know, feeling that it's a need, or like where are you all at in that?
Absolutely. You know, I think as a mental health industry, we have made, golly, big strides, and yet there is still so much that we can do in terms of gaps in services, in terms of attracting people of color to treat and working in these populations. And so I have always worked in industries and in environments that have been predominantly white. And so for me, I see myself as an advocate and being able to bring attention to some of the disparities that we see.
Right.
When we talk about access to care, we're talking about quality treatment. We're talking about having the financial resources in order to seek out quality treatment. It is knowing people like me who can help you navigate the system. And so, you know, as of late, I've been having lots of conversations with my circle that is predominantly Black. I've had lots of conversations with my friends and my family about just what mental health services can do for you. And just knowing that it hasn't necessarily been our culture to seek out mental health services. And I definitely see a shift in that.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm excited for it. And yet I'm excited to bring and recruit people of color to take on this fight as well, both in these companies that are working to provide treatment, as well as working with other organizations who are advocates as well for providing resources.
So basically, you're the answer to what they were missing. You were the secret sauce to bring into Acadia to fill in the gap in the need of time.
I thought they would call me the secret sauce, but you know, I've got other Black women in particular who are here. I think it takes a village to be able to do this. I don't think any one person can take on such a large, large role. Mm-hmm. My gosh, when you think about the people who suffer with, you know, even substance abuse, which is a huge issue in this country. Yes. It takes a lot. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a whole community to be able to bring people to the table and to really encourage treatment.
So you talked about it, you know, like there's a couple of challenges. And of course, African-American communities not seeking out mental health. While they only don't seek out mental health, they don't seek out behavioral health in general. Substance use is included. You know, I always have to advocate for mental health is different from substance addiction.
Yes, it is.
But we don't seek out either one. And as a woman of color myself, I know that. And I think, I know that's why our faith initiative, and we do so much work in that area, is because to seek out alternative but approachable evidence-based practices when it comes to just retention in the treatment, accessibility, meeting people where they're at when it comes to them maybe going to their communities, congregations of faith for that support mm-hmm. when they're looking for mental health, or my substance use problem comes from X, Y, and Z. I just need to go and speak to my pastor about it. And the stigma that goes along with going into like an actual facility, which comes with like, I'm crazy or I don't have no real problem. I just need some painkillers to hear it now and then, but you're taking like 5 every day, you know? So I appreciate you touching on that just because we don't, and to shed the light on really just like breaking down those walls that like I tell young girls all the time, like I went to a counselor in college twice, like when I felt mm-hmm. those like deep dark thoughts, like, and maybe I didn't have a diagnosable symptom or anything, but it's still always good to get those check-ins. And then when it comes to substance use too, and I just think we just shy away until it becomes such a problem where we're like, okay, like it's either like here or now, or I'm gonna, you know, wind up on a situation that's kind of like compromising to my life. So what are some things, like what's going on? I know you're out in the field, you're in LPC out in the field, and as well as at Acadia, so we can talk from either one, and we can talk to both. This is our time to chat. So like, what's going on? I mean, really, that's the real question. What are you seeing? We love to talk to providers that are out there doing the work. I'm at Morehouse School of Medicine, or because of COVID, at home. So a lot of times we don't get to see what's going on. You all get to see and know. You have your ear to the street, as I call it, more so than us that are kind of behind the desk doing the work at the national, state, regional level. So what's going on? What's going on, girl?
Sure. And, you know, I hesitate to kind of be the authority here, but from my perspective, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
you mentioned just the reality of kind of touching into these communities, partnering with our faith leaders. Mm-hmm. I'm a pastor's kid. And yeah. PK. So when I first decided that I wanted to be a therapist, I had lots of questions from my parents of like, what's that?
Right.
And what are you going to do? And people are going to pay you to sit and listen, right?
Right.
And that's not really what I do, for people who are not aware of what therapy is. I don't just sit there and listen and agree and make people feel good.
Right.
But we really do kind of have to look at the system from an individual standpoint and really understanding the system in which someone is embedded. And then understanding what adjustments need to be made in order to kind of promote well-being. And so it's been really cool to see clergy gain some education around that.
Exactly.
And so, you know, my dad just retired from 34 years of being a pastor.
Oh, wow.
We've had probably more conversations around mental health in the last 10 years of me almost being a therapist than I think we really did my whole life.
Okay.
As people are really coming to him in all of these dire situations, and oftentimes, especially in the Black community, our clergy are the first line of defense.
Yep.
And so when I am out really kind of sharing with people what's out there, I am looking at a broad range of people that I can communicate with, because mm-hmm. we never really know where someone is going to look for help.
Right.
It could be the hospital. Exactly. It could be the emergency room. It could be, hopefully, like an outpatient therapist or a psychiatrist. But it doesn't always have to be those crisis situations.
Yep.
And we need to be informed about how to navigate people or point people in the right direction. So COVID is putting a wrench in a lot of things. You know, in a normal year, I would be out and about meeting with providers and really kind of learning about what they do and who they see, and ultimately being able to refer appropriately.
Of course. But what also, is that?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, but what does that look like? What does that look like now? Like how, because I know this thing, especially with peers, you know, the big, you know, question is like, how do we effectively, and I'll throw a plug. We actually have an Ask the Expert for September on just peer support services as of now. Like it's a relationship-based, you know, work that peers do. Like how do you, just as in the same as how do you connect with your people in this time? Like how does your work look? I mean, you have a job, so there's something to be done, right? So how are you engaging in doing this work, you know, now?
Absolutely. Some probably of what you're doing as well. I mean, we are calling people, we are setting up meetings, we are working as best we can to vet hospitals that are going to be good fits for people. We are trying to get in front of people the best way that we know how, mm-hmm. Just to kind of spread the news that there is support out there. Again, looks very different. I would love to say that I would just knock on everybody's door and just kind of fight my way in. And people are locking their doors nowadays. So it definitely looks a lot different.
I went to go get a massage and the door was locked and I had an appointment. They made me stand outside. Everybody's locking the doors. Yeah.
You are a brave one. I'm going to have to talk to you about how that massage went, because I have just been dying for one all year and, you know, haven't been able to make it happen.
We'll save that for after the podcast. You are right. People are locking their doors.
Absolutely. But then at the same token, you know, Celine, these last couple of days, my phone has been ringing off the hook because mm-hmm. people need support
and
they don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so if anything else, this pandemic and everything else that has been going on, I mean, we can probably talk all day about the social unrest that the city has experienced and is experiencing.
Well, we can touch on it.
Okay. You know, it is causing people to really sit and reflect and think about their quality of life.
Yes.
And we're under a lot of stress as human beings, and we're choosing to cope with it in various ways. And so what I can appreciate is, you know, I have a network that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm not able to support you or navigate, you know, the system to support you based on your resources, I have people I partner with that I can call and pick their brains and figure out what the best course of action in trying to help this individual get the help that they need.
Cool. So what, I know you said you're seeing people, and I just want to go back to that question because I might have made a cut off your train of thought and I apologize about that. So I heard you saying you're kind of seeing different approaches, different modalities to get to treatment, residential, you know, care. Mm-hmm. And it looks like one path may be faith or that kind of route. What are kind of like your top challenges when it comes to, we can talk about it from the standpoint of Acadia. How do you, you know, navigate that? You know, maybe do you see resistance? Is it, you know, is it there, you know, health equities that are inequities that are, you know, challenging being able to place certain people? What are those gaps that you're seeing? Where are there barriers to, you know, really doing your job effectively?
Sure. Gosh, this is another topic that I feel like we can spend all day. And sometimes I do day-long trainings and it never feels like enough when we're talking about disparity. So depending on what it is that someone is seeking help for, some of the challenges that I see are stigma.
Okay.
And being able to ask for help and kind of admit that maybe there's something that's going on that they could use some support with.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes in the Black community, seeking help is seen as a sign of weakness.
Yes.
And so oftentimes when I am working with families of color, we're in crisis at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we didn't catch it early enough. They tried to hold on and try to support them as best that they could. And I believe that they really did try. Mm-hmm. And then things got out of hand. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes when we're in that crisis space, it's a lot harder to effectively kind of navigate residential care. Sometimes we're having to step up to an acute setting.
Yep.
So that'd be an inpatient hospital. Mm-hmm. So I think stigma really does prolong people seeking treatment. Another thing that I see, and this was something that did not come up for me until the last couple of years, we don't have a lot of representation in some of our hospitals.
Okay.
And I think that for some people, that's a true barrier. When they don't see people who look like them, or they don't feel like that person is going to understand, mm-hmm. it's a lot harder to open up to somebody about what's really, really going on.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I think that's the main reason mm-hmm. I wanted to do this work. Like, I never saw, like, me going into, like, even when I, you know, went to go see an OBGYN or went to go see, like, healthcare, I never would see it. So I think, and even when I speak to young girls myself, like, in personal business, like, it's always good, especially when little girls see that black dial on the shelf. Like, it just does something for you. So I understand when you say representation. It definitely drives my own personal passion, so I understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for me, it was so heartwarming and almost heartbreaking when I started to get calls for therapy from people of color who felt like they were like, gosh, I was looking for someone black, and I really feel like from your profile, we can connect, and I feel like you get me. Mm-hmm. It used to bring me to tears because it didn't happen at the beginning of my career. I will be really honest that most of my patient load was probably 99% white.
Okay.
And there's no issue with that, I did not see my people seeking out even outpatient therapy. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of ways, another barrier to treatment is therapy and mental health services are a luxury for some.
Mm-hmm. For most.
It does, for most.
Yeah. Or it, that it, could it be does. A that could be a perception too, though.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes we don't, sometimes our community, we may not educate ourselves on what's really out there. So we perceive it as it may being a luxury. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, I'm here and I'm talking to providers, and insurance coverage tends to be a barrier as well.
Of course.
And so I have a lot of colleagues and myself included that have practices that are self-pay only. Mm. And so if people already do not see the value in therapy, it is really hard to kind of wrap your head around investing in your health.
Exactly. Yep.
And so I see that as a challenge for some. And there's times in which I wrestle with that of, how do I give people what they need, but also value the service enough to be able to charge for it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I have been really guilty, and you might need to, you know, edit this part out. But
nope.
I really do try to work with my client where they are.
Right.
And that includes where they are financially. And yeah. So,
but that's the passion in it for you. I'm not going to edit it out because that's passion, honestly. I mean, really give, I mean, if I, when, I won't say if, I'll say when I become OBGYN, I definitely want to meet patients where they are. Like, if you can't, I mean, that's just that passion that you have. Like, I could not, and even if I was a physician that offered mat services, you know, on the flip side of things, I could not see a patient that was pregnant and not be able to help them in some way with their substance use,
sure.
You know, you know, challenges like that would really bother me. So I definitely understand, especially like, well, all I can do is give you my Medicaid to,
for, you know, having a baby. I don't have that added part of my substance use. Like, where do we do that wraparound services? But sometimes you have to lean out your own neck and your own, you know, resources to be able to do that. So I totally understand.
Absolutely. And so I feel like I have some really great colleagues that are open to doing that and open to working on a sliding scale. It is passion, mm-hmm. That drives this. And I think to be a helper, you have to be called to this. It is not for the faint of heart at all.
No.
So when I think about kind of residential care, you know, some of the barriers that I find is really people seeing the value and taking time away to focus on self. Mm-hmm. So when you're thinking about residential care and going away to work on issues related to substance abuse or eating disorders or, you know, mood disorders, trauma, I mean, you're really looking at taking 30, 60, maybe 90 days, going to a residential treatment center and every day waking up with the intention of working on yourself.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. And we are so busy in this world and maybe 2020 has slowed people down. But we don't do that very often.
No, I just said that before we started the call. Like when you say your offer, you don't feel good. And then you're like, but I still need to do this and that. And you're like, no, your body's telling you like, slow down. Yeah. So I totally understand.
Yeah. And I think just kind of understanding what that can and feels like. I mean, I talk to people all the time as we prepare for residential treatment and they're like, well, what am I going to do about my work, my family, whatever. And it is very rare. Actually, I don't think it's ever happened that someone has finished residential treatment, called me and been like, oh my gosh, I wish I had those 30 days back to work.
Right.
Like they're so like, honored to have had the time to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. But we can't see the value sometimes on the front end. We actually have to go through it and see the results in order to really experience that and be able to talk through that. So.
Yep. A part of one of SATTC's initiatives is Minority to Priority. And I think we talked about this because this podcast mm-hmm. definitely falls under that scope of things. And so there's just a ton of different, you know, findings that, you know, show that, you know, minorities such as African Americans are like four or five times more likely to receive those mental health services. And then they, like you said, delay seeking service, and then their retention, is, you know, a barrier that we talk about under Minority to Priority. How do you see that as being like dropouts rates being much higher than, you know, their counterparts, white counterparts?
So I don't know if I have any statistics on that, okay. But I can anecdotally kind of say, especially having run a residential treatment center, I used to give the same speech to every family as they came in and as they left the residential treatment center. And just mm-hmm. the reality that continued work is so important. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we have alluded to that continuum of care. And obviously, it starts at inpatient, which is the most acute, going down to residential, partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient, and then, you know, seeing outpatient providers. And I find a lot of times that people really struggle with that follow through. Mm-hmm. So having 30, 60, 90 days of focused treatment where you don't have a lot of distractions, it's pretty easy to kind of do once you're there.
Right.
Finding time once you get busy again to do that maintenance work, it's a lot tougher. Mm-hmm. And we also need that. Right. I kind of think of it as, you know, having training wheels on a bike. And mm-hmm. so needing to be steady before you just kind of take those off and just kind of run with it. And so I do find that the busyness of life, especially in communities of color, is a hindrance for people having long-term recovery.
Mm-hmm. So I know we talked about, you know, like, so my, I guess I always say in every conversation, you know, when we talk about the problem and the scope and, you know, I just hear that so much and I'm such an action like person, like, okay, so what are we going to do about it? You know, like, so what, So I hear, you know, pretty much my question is like, how do we make this happen? Or how do we meet people where they're at when it's, you know, when people do have ingrained stigma, related trauma when it comes to, oh, I don't know if I should, you know, or, you know, delayed seeking. Besides, you know, I do hear that you provide that financial piece as far as, you know, maybe a sliding scale, just like other providers, but how do you meet people where they're at in other terms? Do they get, and maybe, you know, you could talk about the, you know, kind of the, how a program actually goes. You know, I'm not sure if some people actually fully understand how that process looks from being looped in with you into, okay, I've walked out the door and now I'm quote unquote, you know, better. Maybe that process, but, so how do you send the some there for continued like follow up afterwards? Like, how do we ensure that people, you know, especially minority populations are not falling out of the loop or falling off the bandwagon when it comes to their behavioral health? You know, a lot of times, because that is our, you know, our disparity of it is, you know, our retention and our delayed treatment. How do we meet people where we're at in that, you know, kind of space?
Absolutely. My apologies. So, okay. You know, so much of what we need to do is have conversations like this, make it widespread, make it public, let people hear what is out there and what's really going on. Mm-hmm. Working with me as a treatment placement specialist with Acadia Healthcare is a complimentary service.
Okay.
That I do offer with them. And so individuals can give me a call, providers can give me a call, family members can give me a call. And what I'm really doing is quickly assessing, you know, level of care and what is needed. And from there, just kind of making recommendations. And so if they admit into an Acadia facility, I am going to follow them from start to finish, which includes being able to work with their clinical team on discharge planning.
Okay.
And so there's always a need. And if anybody is listening and is a provider that is passionate about supporting people, I encourage them to reach out to me so that I know and can refer to them for continued care. And we stay close. We hold people accountable. Okay. We get people plugged into healthy communities and okay. in healthy conversation. So it is hard in the sense that we can't make people do
right
what they don't want to do, but we can also offer the services that we have.
Mm-hmm. What type of healthy communities do you plug them into?
Yeah. So it really just depends on what's going on, you okay. know, around
in terms of substance use, maybe so.
Yeah. Getting them connected to an alumni group if they complete a program, getting them connected to AA or any of the free services that are out there, getting mm-hmm. them connected with healthcare providers, mm-hmm. Really encouraging them. And I think this would be a part of any person's treatment plan, making sure that they have options when they return home mm-hmm. to kind of step away from any of those relationships that were not serving them very well and mm-hmm. serving them in health. And I think the best that we can do is create those spaces.
Mm-hmm. So I have a two-pronged question. You know, my mind starts to create questions once I'm listening. So one of our topics was access to care. So first thing I'm thinking is, okay, Acadia, here in Atlanta, I've never heard of that. So how does somebody get plugged in with that? Because, I mean, I'm in tune with, I would like to think I know, you know, where some things are. But as a person that is just a regular citizen of the community in Atlanta, how do they get wrapped into Acadia? Because I'm thinking Grady, I'm thinking Piedmont, Atlanta Medical Center. Like, how do they find you? And then the second part of that question is, when we talked about, you know, looping them into healthy communities after the fact, but what does it actually look like to go through the process once they do find you? You know, what is true access like? Like, where are you all at to provide true access to people who need this?
Exactly. That's a great question. I'm working really hard to kind of get out there.
Okay.
Make sure that people know that I am available to them.
Okay.
So once people are connected and they kind of know, we're reviewing clinical for reviewing the treatment options that I am aware of. Of course, Acadia Healthcare has treatment facilities across the nation for all of the things that, you know, I've mentioned within the world of behavioral health. And so most importantly, I'm making recommendations on clinical fit, but then also making, you know, recommendations based on any of the things that those individuals are bringing to me, whether it be, you know, financial or geographical or even gender, if that is something that they really want me to factor in. And I will try my best to kind of give them a recommendation that's going to work for them. And my job is to kind of partner with people so that if I'm not able to help them for whatever reason or don't have a facility, I can refer them to somebody who would be able to help. And my team is, about 60 people across the nation. And we're pretty well connected. Every program that we refer to is one that we have vetted. And so I love being able to kind of listen to the request of people, and then tap into my team, tap into my network, and be able to provide those recommendations.
So where can people find Joy?
Joy, you can find me. I hope that we'll be able to kind of link some of my contact information.
I meant, where can they find? In 2020, that question does sound like a socials question. Like, can we find you on Instagram? Can we find? I'm so sorry. No. Well, we do want that information too, and that information will be readily available for everybody listening in the bio of the actual podcast. But I meant so much as so once they get wrapped in, but you know, I'm thinking of somebody just walking off of the street, or do they bump into you? Are you at actual programming? Are you at local, facilities that, you know, may not be health, you know, inclusive? Like, how do you connect with the people that need you most? Like, what is your first touch point with them?
Yeah. So my first touch point is usually via phone, as I'm usually kind of out and about and hopefully connecting with other providers as well.
Okay. So through providers, they would get to you through a provider. Okay.
Yep. So they would typically get through me to a provider, but I've absolutely had people who just kind of word of mouth or friends of friends who have gotten my number and connected with me. That's my hope. I hope that I am supporting people so well that they feel confident in the services that I'm providing. So through a provider, through word of mouth, I am out here in these streets. Okay. So you could bump into me and in like a networking event. So I do try to make myself as present as possible.
Okay.
That people find me all types of ways.
Okay.
You can also go to our website, www.treatmentplacementspecialist.com. And actually type in your city and zip code, and your respective treatment placement specialist will actually pop up as well.
Okay. Okay. So that's how they're okay. Because I was thinking maybe you're like at events or, you know, like there's a way for them to, you know, connect that way. Because it seems like you're a hidden gem, literally, like, for people to, you know, and is it more than you in this area or just one?
So it is just me. So I cover the majority of Georgia, with the exception of Savannah and like Statesboro. And then I also span into Alabama as well. So I go as far as Birmingham, Tuscaloosa, Auburn.
Okay.
And then my counterparts pick up on the edges of those territories.
Okay.
But, you know, I am always accessible. If someone reaches out to me and might be outside of my geographic territory,
right,
I will absolutely connect you with your respective treatment placement specialist.
Okay, cool. So what are on your LPC side of things?
Yeah.
My director is a LPCT, so I always get to hear the cool things that she comes up with in her personal private life, but still business. What are some things that, I mean, what are some new things for you in 2020 that you're working on, or a niche that you're looking, of being in as a LPC? How does that going with Joy, in 2020?
In 2020. Well, Joy as LPC is having a love-hate relationship with all of my video conferencing and video telehealth right now. But I'm so glad that we are able to connect in the way that we are. There are so many people that need support. And so, again, happy to meet people where they are. I am very much an extrovert and love feeling energy. And I think there's something powerful sharing space in a room with somebody. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to that day where we can do that more regularly. You know, for me in 2020 and going into 2021, I have worked in a lot of different spaces, and I feel like I have a lot of knowledge to be able to impart on other people. So I am kind of shifting gears and doing more supervision.
Okay.
And so that will probably bleed into 2021. As I continue to do that and continue to consult, I do a lot of advocacy work, and particularly in this space of diversity and inclusion and increasing knowledge base there. So I'm excited to continue to do that, hopefully have more conversations with you and other people in this community, because we need the help, we need the support.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Yeah. What as an actual in supervision, what does that look like? Because that might be a term that some people are not familiar with.
Yeah. So as a licensed clinician, as people are in grad school and outside of grad school, there is a residency period before you are fully licensed. And so it's really an opportunity for pre-licensed individuals to learn a niche under the careful supervision of another licensed clinician.
Mm-hmm.
So because I have often worked in spaces where there haven't been a lot of people of color, I really want to support people in getting that education. And so whether it be substance use or eating disorders, there's such a need. And we talked about a little bit earlier about access to care and representation being a potential barrier. And so I think it's important to train people to see the differences in how people are presenting with these respective mental health disorders.
Okay. Yes. That's awesome answer to that question. I would have been remiss if I didn't ask that.
Yeah, I'm glad that you did.
SATCC by no means doesn't have all the answers, but what we do have is a special project that focuses on education, TA, technical assistance, resource, guiding for young professionals that are pre-service. So we call it our pre-service, HBCU pre-service collaboration. And so in that, we definitely are touching back into the Gen Z millennial space to be able to, to cultivate them, their needs in any way as pre-service. We call them pre-service professionals. And so we work in that space actually of, not so much as teaching them, but giving them resources to see what's out there, what fields, what career paths as well. We always like to share like what each guest, on the podcast does, just so it's not, I'm talking to people or I'm a social worker. There's a different, as we, have talked about with you, there's so many different pathways to get into the work. And, the representation, a lot of this work in this behavior health field is aging out, number one. So there's a ageism kind of problem. So the workforce is, aging out, and there's not a lot of new professionals that are coming into the work that are younger. And so we've done a little bit of research on that. It's one of the things we kind of want to highlight a little bit more, the shortages. Kind of one of the things I've even heard on CNN is how many mental health and behavior health professionals will be needed after this COVID thing, dissolves. It's going to be interesting. It's definitely, I've just heard so many cases of domestic violence rising, substance use rising. There's going to be some work for you, Joy. Okay. That's what I'm trying to say. You're going to get paid in 2021. Because there's going to be no shortage, and unfortunately there'll be no shortage, but a surplus in the amount of, just need that's out there. But this conversation has been, pleasant and fruitful. I know we touched on a majority of, you know, what we wanted to talk about, levels of care, access to care, and also when it comes to residential treatment. But if there's anything other, you know, words, like any myths that you want to debunk about residential care, let us know in our last couple of minutes. But I really appreciate you joining us today. Our podcasts aren't a full hour, but just enough time for us to get in key points. And like you said, to have these discussions, because they are definitely needed, especially in the time that we're in.
Absolutely. Well, I have enjoyed this. I'm very passionate about getting this message out, because you don't have to be in crisis in order to seek out help. Mm-hmm. And so if we can start to normalize this conversation and normalize seeking therapy, my clients know, I believe that we should be treating your visits to therapy just like we would with your annual physical.
I agree.
And normalizing it to be preventive.
I agree.
As opposed to reactive.
Yes.
And since so many of my clients have been working with me for as long as they have, they're starting to kind of recognize, like, it is so much better for them and their quality of life to be doing these checkpoints. Mm-hmm. And so I do want to support my community. It first starts at home, and me modeling that and being able to seek out those services before it kind of gets to that point. Mm-hmm. And also knowing that there is absolutely people who are passionate at every level of care to help people navigate. And I'm happy to be that resource and connecting people.
Awesome. I think I wanted to talk about one thing that you said really quickly, but it slipped my mind, so obviously it wasn't that important. I do know what it is. Sorry. So when you talked about it being a part of, regular care, but I think that's the beauty of something like ESPRT, which is screening, brief intervention to treatment. I might have that acronym wrong off the top of my head on a Thursday morning. But by any means, ESPRT can be used in your PCP, in a lot of those first touch point situations. Yes. So we don't get to crisis mode where we are checking in, we are screening, we are doing that first level of maybe prevention, but maybe that first level of, treatment if it comes to, walking through what, instead of it coming to the point where you do need acute care. So, I definitely, I'm an advocate for ESPRT. I didn't even know I was an advocate for ESPRT, but I think that every PCP should have it. And I know that MSM, GET, we at SAT, I told you we have a lot of answers. We don't have them all. But one thing we do is practitioner provider training. And that is what our bread and butter is of SATTC. Mm-hmm. And so we have these little flip charts that we give, little booklets that they can put into their white coat for a primary care, because we're at the National Center for Primary Care at MSM. So that's, we want to equip primary care physicians in that first touch point, what they call is the traditional frontline hero, to be able to assess some of those mental health, behavioral health concerns up front in the door. So I definitely agree that it should be a part. You should be going to get your pap smear, one counseling visit per year, your cleaning, your dental
Let's
cleaning.
Do it.
It should all be, in there.
It should. And honestly, you have to practice what you preach. So again, modeling that from the inside out, that's how people, I model it for my inner circle and community. And I think that we've definitely normalized just talking.
Yep. I agree. Well, thank you so much, Joy. This has been a pleasure. You all, I really thank you. This is the first episode. I hope we brought it in our new season. There will be plenty of more conversations. This one falls under our Special Populations Initiative, Minority to Priority. We are super excited to speak on providing, resources, products, technical assistance to mental health providers, substance use treatment providers, and primary care physicians who want to seek to elevate their cultural competence in these areas. And so some of these conversations haven't felt comfortable, I know, as a woman of color until now. So 2020 has brought a lot of crazy things, but it has opened a lot of doors to conversations such as this one today. So thank you so much, Joy. It's been a pleasure. And we will sign out. Thank you, guys. Stay tuned. We have some great speakers coming up. So we're looking forward to you. Keep listening. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us, and be sure to check us out on the web at attcnetwork.org/centers/southeast-ATTC/home. We'll see you soon.